Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you all so much for tuning in on this lovely, somewhat rainy Tuesday morning. It is July 28th, 2026, and I am personally a big fan of the weather, but it looks like it's going to be warming up soon enough. So for those rain haters out there, your time will soon come. And before we get started with today's broadcast, I just want to acknowledge that this program, as well as all of our programs here at CJSF, are broadcasted on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hoklamilam and Squamish speaking peoples, who have been here on these lands since time immemorial. And we have some local news from all around BC coming at you this hour, but before we get into any of that, let's start off with some local music. This is coming from the Golden Age of Wrestling off of their latest album, Sweet Chin Music. This one's Map to the Stars.
Thank you.
Reporting from New Westminster, BC, this is Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. The city of New Westminster is currently hosting a summer spice drive until August 28th. According to city staff, the New Westminster Summer Spice Drive is a cooking spice collection event taking place throughout the summer season for local food providers and food banks in New Westminster. The idea for this came from the city's Food Security and Systems Plan Working Group, which had been receiving feedback on the need for more culturally preferred foods for residents of New Westminster. To learn more about the Spice Drive, the reception it's received so far, and where people can donate, we reached out to New Westminster social planner Christina Rucci. From speaking with her, it became clear that one of the goals of this spice drive is to diversify the output of New Westminster's food banks in a way that reflects the diverse population of the city itself.
Last year, in December 2025, our council endorsed our food security and systems plan. So this plan really looks at where the gaps are in our food system, how we can fill them. It is a lot around kind of the downstream, like how can we feed people right now? But, you know, we have some upstream measures as well, which kind of lead to more sustainability of our food system. So as we were doing the engagement for this plan, we talked to a lot of folks who use our local food banks. And one of the things that came up more than anything else, I would say, is the lack of culturally preferred foods at food banks. And so many of our food, like our food providers across New West, are actually agency partners of the Greater Vancouver Food Bank. And so they get a lot of their supplies from the food bank, and spices and culturally preferred foods are missing. So we kind of thought, like, an easy, kind of fun way to help people, help their meals and make them more flavorful, is that we would remind them I'm home a little bit, is to do a spice drive. And so that was kind of the idea behind it. And so that's what we did.
We also then talked about what sort of spices are being asked for in particular.
It was kind of hard to figure out which spices would be the most preferred by people. So I just kind of, you know, I did a quick kind of survey and Google search of what the most popular spices are for people from, you know, Eritrea or the bigger kind of populations in New West that might be using food banks and food services. So, you know, we kind of came up with kind of a pretty broad list: cumin, paprika, garlic powder, curries.
Lastly, Christina Rucci spoke on the specific areas that people in New Westminster are able to donate their spices throughout the summer.
So we have City Hall at 511 Royal Avenue, Queensborough Community Center, Tamasat Aquatic and Community Center, the Anvil Center, and Fraser Health Public Health Unit, which is at 610 6th Street. It's kind of upstairs, and so they actually have great hours as well. They're open till 7:30 at night, so a little bit later. The New West Farmers Market will also be collecting them on Thursdays, so they have a bin there as well for people to drop off their spices.
That was Christina Rucci, a social planner for the City of New Westminster, speaking on the Summer Spice Drive, which aims to provide spices to local food banks and food providers for the city of New Westminster. This has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. We are... We are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. And that was my interview with Christina Rucci, social planner with New Westminster, speaking on the Summer Spice Drive, which I thought was just a really fascinating idea for a food drive initiative. You know, obviously, food banks play an extremely important role and, unfortunately, an ever increasingly important role in our society. But often the focus is put on, you know, like canned non-perishable foods, as it should. You know, people need sustenance, but at the same time, food is culture and food is joy. And being able to have access to those spices that make food what it is really important as well. So, yeah, go donate some spices if you have them. And it'll be going on all summer until August 28th. We're moving on to another piece I did a few weeks back, but this is an exhibition that is not going anywhere anytime soon. This is Interglacial at the Reach Gallery Museum in Abbotsford, and my conversation with Desiree Patterson. Hope you enjoy. Reporting from Abbotsford, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Interglacial. A warmer period of time defined by the end of one ice age and the start of another. Yet, with our current era being defined by ever-increasing climate change, that cycle becomes more and more precarious. Interglacial. Desiree Patterson's new exhibition at the Reach Gallery Museum, which is focused on that precarity and the climate crisis we find ourselves in. The product of her work as the 2025 Artist in Residence for the United Nations Year for Glaciers Preservation, Interglacial consists of five new installations, each inspired by the environmental climate scientists she partnered with during her residency. Through these partnerships, Patterson utilized the scientific data collected, shaping it into lens-based and non-lens-based artwork and imagery. There are images that highlight 100 years of glacial degradation, suspended smoky pieces of wood that evoke British Columbia's now yearly wildfire seasons, and a massive structure of cyanotype textiles connected and hung to form the shape of a glacier. The exhibit is a grand immersive experience. However, at the heart of any creative work is the reason behind it. And when we got the chance to speak with Patterson during Interglacial's opening tour, she made that reason immediately clear.
This exhibition is primarily, even on the introduction didactic, this is dedicated to my daughter. I have a six-year-old daughter, her name is Meadow, and it is really my concern for her future and future generations after, what they're inheriting. And I think one of the most beautiful aspects of this past year and of my experience is approaching all of this wanting to bring forth information and empower and engage and rally. I'm also absolutely bursting with hope in this moment. And it's because I've just spent a year working alongside and personally, you know, being able to engage with these researchers that are essentially providing the blueprints and, you know, the policy and all the information required to have a more hopeful future. I just got to hang out with them for a year and see the kind of people doing this work. So another key component of this communication is also to help restore the faith in science. And I think by trying to humanize that and share this research in a different way, but also through the video didactics and the interviews that we have accompanying every single section that really do highlight these researchers and these scientists and their life's dedication work, I really hope that that is also communicated through this exhibition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was gonna ask you about the hope aspect specifically, because, you know, there are parts of this exhibition that do provide like this outlook of hope regarding our current climate, but at the same time, you also see photos and images of wildfires and 100 years of difference between glacial landscapes. It wouldn't surprise me if someone saw that and immediately their hope is kind of like gone, just from looking at that alone. So where do you suggest, or where do you find hope
in the work that you do that looks so closely at climate change and how things have unfortunately progressed in the past century?
I find hope in people. I find hope in humans. And it's really beautiful to say that, because I often hear people say, oh, look at what humans have done to this planet. We don't deserve this world. And notions like that. But I don't buy that at all. I see people doing selfless work. I see scientists, you know, taking time away from their families to do extensive field work across summers, and these inherently creative people and curious people devoting their life to understanding one little part of an ecosystem. That gives me hope to see people that filled with love and that filled with passion. It gives me hope to have conversations with other like-minded Canadians and understand that they carry the same kind of concerns that I do. Having a six-year-old daughter is, I think, hope. You know, the youth of this generation are weighted with, I think, a lot of complicated situations that they've inherited. But I think they're rallying, and what I see, like the Greta Thunbergs of the world, that gives me hope. And I think also just like knowing from a lot of the different high-level researchers that I have had the privilege to speak with, there are fundamental feedback systems in nature that allow this planet to be so regenerative. And we haven't breached that yet. So in this moment, I have hope, because we can change the trajectory that we're on. That's a fact. That isn't an opinion or an optimistic view. It is a cold, hard fact. What we need is that political will, and what we need is that we need that conviction for everybody to stand up and demand it right here, right now. And I think it's coming, and I think it's going to happen. And as an individual, this show is just my way of helping, trying to foster that.
Mm-hmm. Another question I had was, you know, that when we went through each section of this exhibition, you kind of named every single section as having its own muse. And, you know, working with scientific researchers, I'd imagine as much as you initially weren't as familiar with, like, their scientific process, they probably also weren't familiar at all with how exhibitions or art galleries work. How did they feel about being, like, direct inspirations for how this exhibition was put together?
That is such a great question. They're all such modest people. So they've all been kind of, I think, really curious to see this portrayal. But like you said, we come from different worlds, and you know, an analytical brain is often firing different thoughts and different ways of seeing than a creative brain. So to me, and to many of them, it's a really beautiful partnership. It really kind of enhances the ability to tell a story and to communicate, I think, in a fuller, richer way. But I think I haven't had the opportunity for them to actually see their work yet. And I'm really looking forward to that moment, to actually just looking into their eyes and just seeing how they receive what my contemporary translation of them as a researcher is. And I think just from the conversations that I've had, even just from doing the field work, they're really excited about it. You know, most of scientific findings is communicated through papers circulated amongst academic institutions and in those communities. And it almost, you know, compared to like the public audiences, it's almost like an esoteric language. And so I think they're really excited to see how art can kind of bridge that, and how engagement can be fostered through different means than intellect, I guess.
In saying that, the last question I had, it might be a bit of a loaded one, but for those who do attend this exhibition, is there a central takeaway that you hope audiences have when looking at this as a whole?
Yeah. Well, there's a few. I hope people take the time to just experience the work for themselves. I hope that people have the opportunity to watch some of the interviews and have the opportunity to form a sense of trust with the people who are sharing this really important information of this moment with us, the experts that know these ecosystems, that know these dynamics, these feedbacks, these models, these forecasts, and have that time and space to discern for themselves, you know, what they resonate with and what they feel educated by. And then I hope that what this shows as an exhibition as a whole is an act of advocacy. So as an individual, I started getting involved in environmentalism before it ever permeated into my practice. And I realized early on, you know, I'm marching in climate rallies, I've, you know, became a vegetarian, I've lowered my carbon footprint, all these kinds of things. And I know that the notion is, it's like, oh, well, that's so much, but really, does it have an impact? And you know what? It does have an impact on your health, for sure. It's a positive, because anything I've ever done environmentally focused has actually benefited my health. But does it affect, you know, greenhouse gas emissions by large? Probably not. But it has affected my mental health. It has affected me feeling positive and feeling accountable to the future. But I realized that the loudest voice that I would have as an individual is through my creative practice. So what this show is an individual citizen who is just trying to use the unique skills that they have to communicate something really important to their heart. We all have the capacity to do this. We all have unique skill sets. We all have passion that we carry in our heart, and we have a voice that we need to use for those who don't have one. That's what I hope the takeaway is. Whatever it is, whatever calls you to your heart and soul, and whatever you have as your unique talents, your gifts, your place in this world, we need everybody in this moment to stand up, and we need everybody to voice, and we need everybody to advocate for the future that we want.
Once again, that was our conversation with Desiree Patterson, the exhibiting artist for Interglacial at the Reach Gallery Museum in Abbotsford. The opening of the exhibition was on July 11th, but this exhibition will be on until March 20th, 2027 at the Reach Gallery Museum. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. And we are back with Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. That was my interview with Desiree Patterson. Thank you to Desiree. Thank you to everyone at the Reach Gallery Museum. And yeah, go check it out. It's in Abbotsford for quite a few months. So it's not going anywhere. And hopefully you will be, though. Anyway, I don't know where I was going with that. Thank you for tuning in. We're going to be moving on to a news piece coming out of Nanaimo, BC. This is from our friends at CHLY, and it is about Nanaimo honoring Japanese-Canadian history with new legacy projects at parks, something that I think is going on around all of BC, throughout Vancouver Island, the Gulf Islands, and just the Lower Mainland as well. So there'll be more stories, I think, regarding this topic in particular coming up, but here is one from Nanaimo.
This is a CHLY news update. The city of Nanaimo is honoring the history of the Japanese-Canadian community with the development of two projects at local parks. Downtown's MacGregor Park at Nanaimo's harborfront is planned to become the site of a permanent landscape art installation. Over at Bevan Park, a new outdoor performance space will be built to celebrate cultural performances, hosting storytelling, music, educational programming, and community gatherings. The city has been working with the Central Vancouver Island Japanese-Canadian Society, also known as Seven Potatoes, on the projects. The society is an organization dedicated to celebrating Japanese culture in Canada, preserving the history of Japanese Canadians, and working towards a more multicultural Canada. Tami Hirasawa is president of Seven Potatoes. She shares the plan for the MacGregor Park project.
So there's like a wall that's going to go sort of where a clock is and in amongst the cherry trees. And there's going to be new seating area right where the MacGregor Park, you know, tiered seating is. And benches that resemble Sei Sitchin and Protection Island. And it's the wall is going to be really telling the story of the Japanese Canadian history.
She describes the Bevan Park Outdoor Performance Stage.
The Bevan Park community is really for the community for today. The McGregor Park at the waterfront is more the history of the Japanese Canadians, and the one at Bevan is a legacy park. It's really for the community to gather and celebrate together, and to have like all Nanaimo people, you know, come and celebrate together.
Kurosawa says Japanese immigrants began arriving in Nanaimo in the 1890s, where most settled in the Brechin area, specifically in Juniper and Stewart Avenue. Many came from Japan with experiences in fishing, shipbuilding, mining, and logging, and they quickly used those skills to establish a thriving neighborhood of homes and businesses. Hirasawa continues to explain the history of the Japanese community in Nanaimo as a community settled into Vancouver Island.
The Japanese Canadians built a Japanese language school for their children in the 1920s, and that was located at Juniper and Stewart Avenue. And they also were very involved in the fishing industry. So a lot of Japanese came over from Japan and had shipbuilding experience and fishing experience. And so they were very hardworking and a real economic contribution to Nanaimo in that time.
As the community grew, so did their contributions. Japanese Canadians established herring salteries, where the fish were salted before being exported to Japan, China, and other overseas markets. According to the Nanaimo Art Gallery, Nanaimo is known as a herring capital, having 43 herring salteries due to the abundance of the fish. Although the community thrived, Japanese Canadians faced discrimination. According to Hirasawa, they were denied the right to vote, which led to them facing restrictions in employment. They also faced laws that limited their fishing permits, with racism and discrimination intensifying around 1907. According to the Royal BC Museum, that year anti-Asian riots in Vancouver impacted Japanese Canadian residents and businesses, leading to the Government of Canada taking steps that restricted immigration from Japan. According to the Canadian Museum of Human Rights, discrimination further intensified after Canada declared war on Japan in 1941 following the Japanese attacks on Pearl Harbor. Within days, the government forcibly relocated thousands of Japanese Canadians from the BC coast to interior internment camps. Their property and possessions were sold off, with those impacted seeing little to no compensation. Hirasawa explains the impact of the racial discrimination Japanese Canadians suffered during this time amidst the outbreak of war with Japan in 1941.
When we were at war with Japan, within 24 hours of Canada declaring war on Japan, they had all of the fishing boats rounded up and basically were in the possession of the custodian of enemy alien property. So that happened very quickly. And it's because they had already racially profiled all the Japanese Canadians prior to 1941.
According to the Legislative Assembly of British Columbia, even after the war ended in 1945, Japanese Canadians were not allowed to return to the coast until April 1st, 1949. With the war over, old residents returned to rebuild their lives and continue building their community. Charlotte Davis is the acting director of the Parks, Recreation, and Culture Department. She speaks on the experience collaborating with Seven Potatoes on the two projects.
Yeah, it's been in the works for a while, and it's been a very collaborative process. In fact, it's one of the things that our department does fairly regularly, is working on projects with the community in terms